July 25th, 1908. My dear mother, the greatest surprise to me so far has been the utmost simplicity of life at Sagamore Hill. I am constantly asking myself if this can really be the home of the President of the United States, and how is it possible for him to enforce such simplicity in his environment? It might be the home of a well-to-do farmer with literary tastes, or the house of some college professor. There was no one at the house when we got there. Mrs. Roosevelt had been out to see some sick neighbor, and the President was playing tennis. They both came in together, however, he in tennis garb, and she in a simple white muslin with a large white hat of some cloth material with flowers in it, a wobbly kind of hat which seemed to go with trees and water. He welcomed us with his characteristic handshake, and she, most graciously and kindly. The President was so keen for us to take a swim that he did not give us time to see our rooms before we were on the way to the beach. I do not know when I have enjoyed anything so much. I could not help remarking how pretty and young Mrs. R. looked in her bathing suit. I did not admire his, however, for it was one of those one-piece garments and looked more like a suit of overalls than a bathing suit, and I presume he did not think it dignified for the President to wear one of those abbreviated armless suits, which we all think are so becoming. I confess to liking to have as much skin surface in contact with the water as possible. Dinner was at 8, and we hurried home to put on evening clothes. I had asked Mrs. R. if the President dressed for dinner, and she said that he always wore his dinner jacket, but to wear anything I wanted, as the only rule they had at Oyster Bay was that they had no rules or regulations. I finally wore white trousers and white waistcoat, with a dinner jacket and black tie. He said it was a costume he liked more than any other for summer, and that he often wore it himself. He put Mrs. Winthrop on his right, and I sat on his left. There was no special formality, and the only deference which was paid to the President was the fact that all the dishes were handed to him first, then to Mrs. Roosevelt, and after that to the guest of honor, and so on. Miss Ethel was late in coming to dinner, and everyone, including the President, rose. From the conversation which followed, I learned that it had always been the rule to be on time for their meals, and this remark started the Roosevelt ball rolling. The President said that he thought that Ethel ought to try to be on time, too, that he preferred that no notice be taken of him when he came to his meals late, but that since Mrs. Roosevelt, with a deferential wave of the hand toward her, insisted upon this modicum of respect being paid to the President, he always tried to be on time to his meals. Mrs. Roosevelt said that she did not insist upon the mark of respect being shown to the President, but to their father, whereupon all laughed, and Ethel said that she would try to be on time to all her meals except breakfast. I was very hungry and enjoyed my dinner, being helped twice to nearly everything. We had soup, fish, fried chicken, and corn on the cob, and jelly. There was nothing to drink but water. The President asked me if I would have something, but as it was not the custom, I declined. "We often have something," the President said, "so do not hesitate to take what you want. We are not the tipplers that our friends in Wall Street would make us out, but don't mistake us for prohibitionists." I forgot to mention the fact that the fried chicken was covered with white gravy, and oh, so good. The President said that his mother had always said it was the only way to serve fried chicken, that it gave the gravy time to soak into the meat, and that if the gravy was served separately, he never took it. Ted is now grown up, and, while not handsome, has a keen face, and is certainly clever, and has a splendid sense of humor. Kermit is very attractive in manner and in appearance, and I have an idea that he is his mother's favorite, though of course she would deny it, just as you do when accused of favoring me over the others. Archie is the one who was so ill, and still looks very delicate. He is the pugnacious member, evidently, for he takes up the cudgel at every chance. Quentin is the youngest, and a large, bouncing youngster, who brought in his last-made kite to show his father, and who explained to me the merits of the new-fangled kites for flying purposes, which controversy would not interest you in the least. There, I have introduced you to the family, and will stop, as lunch is nearly ready, the first bell having been some 10 minutes ago. By the way, the bell is a cowbell, just the kind you hear on cows in the cow lot, but sounds just as sweet as any other if one is hungry. After lunch, the women retired to snooze. Ethel walked her dog, and the boys rode out to spend the night on the Mayflower. Butt and Winthrop sat smoking on the porch with Roosevelt, gazing down the slope of Sagamore Hill to the Sound. There were no other houses to be seen anywhere, just a rich variety of trees lower down, and then nothing but water. The talk naturally drifted to Taft, his impending acceptance speech, and his prospects for election. Roosevelt admitted to some worries on the last score. If the people knew Taft, there would be no doubt of his election. They know what he has done, but they don't know the man. If they knew him, they would know that he can be relied on to carry out the policies which I stand for. He is committed to them just the same as I am, and has been made the mouthpiece for them as frequently as I. But said that Taft's major problem was the residuary legatee idea. However, his legacy also included the president's popularity. Yes, Roosevelt said, I think so. Captain Butt stayed at Sagamore Hill for 4 more days, enchanted by the Roosevelt family, while they in turn found him to be unflappable, tireless, well-bred, and discreet. Like the president, he was a heroic trencherman, and matched Roosevelt plate by oversized plate, from double helpings of peaches and cream for breakfast, followed by fried liver and bacon and hominy grits with salt and butter. Why, Mr. President, this is a Southern breakfast. Through 3-course lunches and meat dinners, suppurating with fat. You think me a large eater, Butt wrote in his next letter home. Well, I am small in comparison to him, but he has a tremendous body and really enjoys each mouthful. I never saw anyone with a more wholesome appetite. And then he complains of not losing flesh. I felt like asking him today, how can you expect to? Between meals, there was much strenuous activity, but discovered during a midsummer deluge, as Ambassador Jusserand had discovered during a February snowstorm, that Roosevelt considered tennis to be a game for all seasons. The sodden ball was smashed to and fro. Swimming and water fighting, too, were, by their nature, compatible with rain. When heat built up in the woods, the president was impelled to seize an axe and get in fuel for the winter. I think Mr. Roosevelt cuts down trees merely for the pleasure of hearing them fall, Bud wrote, just as he swims and plays tennis merely for the pleasure of straining his muscles and shouting. Yet when he reads, he has such powers of concentration that he hears no noise around him and is unable to say whether people have been in the room or not. The president's strenuosity extended even to ghost stories. I want ghosts who do things. I don't care for the Henry James kind of ghosts. I want real sepulchral ghosts, the kind that knock you over and eat fire. None of your weak, shallow apparitions. Much of Roosevelt's library time that weekend was devoted to books and maps about Africa. He talked about it continually. You know how you feel when you have all but finished one job and are eager to get at another? Well, that is how I feel. I sometimes feel that I am no longer president. I am so anxious to get on this trip. He hoped that by the time he came down the Nile to meet up with Edith in Cairo, he would be sufficiently forgotten to return home without being a target for the newspapers. Winthrop asked what quarry he feared the most in East Africa. The answer came promptly. You can kill the lion by shooting him in any part of the body, but his alertness and agility make him the most dangerous to me. Roosevelt moved on to discuss the King of Abyssinia, Albert Beveridge's affectations, Shakespeare's compressed thought, and the Book of Common Prayer, with interspersed witticisms that had his listeners roaring with laughter. His humor is elusive, his wit so dashing and his thoughts so incisive, that I find he is the hardest man to quote that I have ever heard talk. Butt wrote. In conversation he is a perfect flying squirrel, and before you have grasped one pungent thought, he goes off on another limb, whistling for you to follow. Despite the president's tendency to dominate every gathering, Butt gradually became aware of a sort of feminine luminiferous ether at Sagamore Hill, pervading everything and everybody. Edith Roosevelt's cool discipline held the big crowded house together, as it had the White House. She made no effort to cajole or criticize her children or guests, manipulating them simply by her own quiet example. Over breakfast on Sunday morning, she announced that she and the president were going to church, but expected no one to accompany them unless conscience so dictated. Captain Butt, who could take religion or leave it, could also take a hint. Knowing them both to be Protestant, he ventured an anti-Catholic remark during the automobile ride to Christ Episcopal Church. Roosevelt gave him a quizzical look. "Archie, when I discuss the Catholic Church, I am reminded that it is the only church which has ever turned an Eastern race into a Christian people. Is that not so?" 40 little boys saluted as the president led the way into the little church on Shore Road. Captain Butt joined him and Mrs. Winthrop in the front family pew, while Edith, Ethel, and Kermit sat behind. Butt was intrigued to see that Roosevelt, a member of the Dutch Reformed Church, bowed his head in prayer, just as all good Episcopalians do, before the service started. He needed no prayer book, singing all the plain song chants and the Te Deum by heart. He sang every hymn, too, changing sometimes to a lower octave, somewhat surprising for a man whose speaking voice broke so often into falsetto. His only concession to the faith of his fathers, so far as Butt could see, was a refusal to bow his head during the Creed and again at the Gloria. "I came to the conclusion before the service was over that the President was at heart an Episcopalian, whatever his earlier training might have been." Asked afterward what his favorite hymns were, Roosevelt listed "How Firm a Foundation," followed by "Holy, Holy, Holy, Jerusalem the Golden," and "The Son of God Goes Forth to War." He indulged in no sports that afternoon, explaining to Butt that although Sabbath observance meant little to him personally, it meant a lot to many Americans, and he felt an obligation, as president, to respect such common beliefs. Butt's last day at Sagamore Hill, Tuesday, 28 July, was the eve of William Howard Taft's long-awaited acceptance speech in Cincinnati. Roosevelt again revealed that he was worried about his candidate. He sensed a general lack of enthusiasm for the Republican ticket, in contrast to Bryan's gathering strength. The commoner still impressed him. "And he is not a charlatan either. He is a splendid politician and a wonderful leader. He has met with nothing but defeat so far, and yet he is stronger today than ever and will be the hardest man to beat, whatever the papers may say to the contrary." President and aide sat that night on the porch in a flood of moonlight, talking about many things. Roosevelt confessed another fear, which he had entertained for the past year and a half, that of war with Japan. He did not think it would come soon, but he was sure it would one day. "No one dreads war as I do, Archie. The little I have seen of it, and I have only seen a little, leaves a horrible picture in my mind." The surest way to postpone it, he said, was to prepare for it as much as possible, and show evidence of a steely willingness to fight. That was why he had authorized the Great White Fleet to proceed across the Pacific, stopping en route at Yokohama. Taft's speech seemed to bear out Roosevelt's belief that he intended no backward step from the policies of the current administration. He pledged himself to clinch what has already been accomplished at the White House, and said that his chief work would be to complete and perfect the machinery by which the president's policies may be maintained. With that, he returned to Hot Springs to complete and perfect the machinery of his golf game, which, to the consternation of Republican strategists, interested him much more than politics. Now began what the veteran Philadelphia Press reporter Henry L. Stoddard called a silent boycott of TR. Roosevelt did not notice it at first, since he bombarded Taft with letters of advice almost daily and received courteous, if not very forthcoming, replies. Only slowly, as August progressed, did he realize that no cabinet officers were being summoned to Hot Springs. If Taft had meant what he said about wanting to work with them in future, he was not showing much present interest in their counsel. Neither was he sending for any of the president's state or national lieutenants. Roosevelt could only assume that Taft wished, quite understandably, to counteract the residuary legatee factor. Plump, lovable Will must know what he was doing. If not, the rather less lovable Mrs. Taft certainly did. The presidential campaign of 1908 began in earnest after Labor Day, but earnestness did not translate into energy. Ideologically, the two main candidates were hampered by the fact that there was little difference between their respective platforms. The Republican Party was for the protective tariff, but not averse to reforming it. The Democratic Party wanted revision, but shrank from the idea of free trade. Both camps vowed a limited war on monopoly, called for more railroad regulation, and demanded fairer treatment for labor. Theodore Roosevelt may have been excluded physically from the campaign, but its very blandness was testimony to his de ipse domination of American politics. He could have written either platform himself. He fretted, longing to get involved, as he had during his own campaign 4 years before. "For reasons which I am absolutely unable to fathom," he wrote Elihu Root, "Taft does not arouse the enthusiasm which his record and personality warranted us in believing he ought to arouse." A note of irritation, as of a patron taken too much for granted, colored his continuing advice to the candidate. He stopped just short of giving direct orders. "You should put yourself prominently and emphatically into this campaign. Also, I hope to see everything done henceforth to give the impression that you are working steadily in the campaign. It seems absurd, but I am convinced that the prominence that has been given to your golf playing has not been wise, and from now on I hope that your people will do everything they can to prevent one word being sent out about either your fishing or your playing golf. The American people regard the campaign as a very serious business, and we want to be careful that your opponents do not get the chance to misrepresent you as not taking it with sufficient seriousness." Without being so tactless as to refer to the widely published image of Taft in mid-swing, trying to circumnavigate his own circumference, he warned him to stay away from candid press cameras. "I never let friends advertise my tennis, and never let a photograph of me in tennis costume appear." He tried to coach Taft in the art of personality projection. "Let the audience see you smile always, because I feel that your nature shines out so transparently when you smile, you big, generous, high-minded fellow." But back of the smile, there should be the aggression of a fighter for the right. Hit at them. Challenge Bryan on his record. As September progressed, with little noticeable change in traditional party loyalties, Roosevelt calmed down. Every vote for the status quo ante was a vote for continued GOP dominance of all three branches of government. Only one discord, an unresolvable one, affected Republican harmony. It was that of Brownsville. The Senate Committee on Military Affairs may have upheld the president's action, and Foraker may have been eliminated as a candidate, but the anger of black voters in such key states as Ohio and New York was potentially threatening to Taft. They did not have to give their support to Bryan to cripple his candidacy. If they were merely solid in refusing to vote at all, he could lose and lose. Roosevelt got, if not consolation for the major mistake of his presidency, a certain grim satisfaction out of seeing Foraker totally humiliated on 17 September. William Randolph Hearst, stumping for the Independence Party, revealed the existence of letters between Foraker and Standard Oil's John D. Archbold, going back over a period of years that amounted to black-and-white proof of a senatorial purchase. Sums as large as $50,000 were itemized as fees and payments for vague legal services and understandings that clearly involved legislation. Foraker, devastated, admitted the authenticity of the letters, but claimed that they related to law work only, which he had performed during intersessional times, and before such outside work was frowned upon by the Senate. At least one check, the largest, had been not a payment but a loan from Standard Oil to help a colleague buy a newspaper. Hearst had neglected to mention the fact that Foraker had paid Archbold back within a month. These qualifications, however, had little effect on public outrage. Foraker himself neglected to explain how $150,000 in corporate contributions toward the redecoration of his Washington mansion in no way related to his defense of corporations on Capitol Hill. He was, overnight, a dead man, politically, and Roosevelt urged Taft to make the most of his demise. "I would have it understood in detail what is the exact fact, namely, that Mr. Foraker's separation from you and me has been due not in the least to a difference of opinion on the Negro question, which was merely a pretense. Make a fight openly on the ground that you stood in the Republican Party and before the people for the triumph over the forces which were typified by the purchase of a United States senator to do the will of the Standard Oil Company. Taft, however, was not a fighter, either open or covert. Lacking aggression, all he wanted was to be loved. For the most part, this need served him well on the hustings. Audiences forgave his lackluster speaking style and warmed to his portly, always cheerful demeanor. When pressing flesh, he discharged none of Roosevelt's galvanizing energy, but instead imparted an unthreatening, gentle glow. He was everybody's favorite fat uncle from childhood, dispensing coins and lollipops. Bryan's brazen vocal cords were worked to the limit as he crisscrossed the country, meeting large and rapturous audiences wherever he went, and saying little to tax either his or their own mental abilities. But, as James Bryce sympathetically observed, that a man who talks so much should be able to think at all is amazing. Roosevelt returned to Washington on 23 September and plunged into the only kind of campaign work he could, barring a request, which never came, to tour on behalf of Taft. He fired off a series of press statements and public letters, attacking every candidate in the Democratic ranks who seemed vulnerable to charges of corruption or any other sins on the calendar of human frailty. His biggest triumph was in causing the resignation of the treasurer of the Democratic campaign, Charles N. Haskell, also on account of links to Standard Oil, which by now was equated in the public mind with Attila's Kingdom of the Huns. That the links had been first announced, again, by Hearst, in no way spoiled Roosevelt's satisfaction in having deeply embarrassed Bryan. "How the president does enjoy a fight when there is need of one," James Garfield wrote in his diary. Taft came to Washington only once, on 18 October. He was fresh from a tour of the Baptist South and feeling somewhat bruised by the hostility of evangelicals toward his Unitarian faith. Roosevelt sympathetically went to church with him. "I did this," he wrote Kermit, "hoping that it would attract the attention of sincere but rather ignorant Protestants who support me, and would make them tend to support Taft also." It was the first time president and candidate had met since July. Roosevelt was pleased to find Taft, as ever, just a dear, and confident of victory in a majority of states. Dixie, after all, had never been GOP territory. The nearest thing to a campaign debate that month was that over the use of injunctions in labor disputes. Unions claimed that corporations had too much power, under existing law, to force strikers back to work by unduly influencing judges. Samuel Gompers of the AFL castigated the Republican Party for reneging on instructions from Roosevelt himself earlier in the year to adopt an anti-injunction plank. But the issue appealed only to a hardcore of union voters, and the president neutralized it by publishing one of his typical public letters accusing Gompers of impugning the integrity of the courts. On 26 October, Roosevelt released another epistle, 4,000 words long, summarizing Taft's fair-minded labor policies as a judge in the 1890s and as the cabinet officer responsible for the well-being of workers in the Panama Canal Zone. He proudly identified himself as an honorary locomotive fireman and announced that no less a personage than the Secretary-Treasurer of the International Brotherhood of Steam Shovel and Dredge Men was going to vote Republican. The following day, Theodore Roosevelt turned 50. He celebrated with a solitary ride, jumping all the hurdles in Rock Creek Park. "That is, Roswell jumped them," he wrote Jules Jusserand. "I just sat on his back and admired the scenery." By now it was apparent that Taft was going to win, in a victory proportionate to his size, if not his stature. Ohio black leaders announced for him, the Republican labor vote remained loyal, and Bryan's search for a last-minute, election-breaking issue failed. The president did not deny himself credit for having turned Taft into an effective campaigner. "I told him he must treat the political audience as one coming not to see an etching, but a poster," he said to Jusserand and Archie Butt. "He must, therefore, have streaks of blue, yellow, and red to catch the eye, and eliminate all fine lines and soft colors." Changing the subject, Roosevelt began excitedly to discuss a lecture he had been invited to give at Oxford University after he emerged from Africa. It was to be entitled Biological Analogies in History, and would discuss the continuance and disappearance of species as illustrative of the limitations of social Darwinism. He was already deep into paleontological and sociological research. To save time, he was dictating the lecture while Joseph DeCamp painted his portrait. He wanted both it and another paper, commissioned by the Sorbonne, to be well in hand before he devoted himself entirely to safari preparations. Jusserand, who had come to the executive office for tea, had to keep listening until almost 8 o'clock. Captain Butt was finally permitted to escort him out. "Was there ever such a man before?" the ambassador asked. Chapter 32, the last chapter. One long, lovely, crackling row. Mr. Dooley: "Well, I see Congress has got to work again." Mr. Hennessy: "The Lord save us from harm." On 3 November 1908, Edith Roosevelt was dismayed to hear that Pine Knot had fallen to William Jennings Bryan. The fake telegram was sent by her husband, radiant over the election of William Howard Taft as 24th President of the United States. He regarded the vote as a vindication of his own record and a guarantee of 4 more years of Rooseveltism. "We have beaten them to a frazzle." The next morning, he arrived in the executive office in high good humor. James Garfield and Captain Butt were waiting to see him. "You army officers and politicians who still have futures before you may continue the struggle," he said, taking his secretary by the hand, "but Mr. Loeb and I will sing the Nunc Dimittis." Taft's Electoral College majority was overwhelming at 321 votes over Bryan's 162. He also helped maintain the Republican control of both houses of Congress. His popular plurality was less so, 1,269,606 votes over Bryan, a decisive total, but only half as impressive as Roosevelt's landslide in 1904. Missouri reverted to the Democratic Party. Other Republican losses were in Colorado, Nebraska, and Nevada, along with the new state of Oklahoma. Indiana, Minnesota, Montana, North Dakota, and Ohio chose Democratic governors. Charles Evans Hughes retained New York by the merest of whiskers, and Roosevelt began contemptuously referring to him as the Bearded Lady. Bryan was gracious, even self-mocking, after his third failed run for the White House. He said he identified with the legendary Texan drunk, who tried to get into a bar and was escorted out. Trying again, he was hustled out. Trying yet again, he was thrown out. "I guess," said the drunk, brushing dust from his clothes, "they don't want me in there." Any hopes Roosevelt might have had that Taft would return to Washington to plot an ideologically continuous transition were disappointed when the president-elect headed straight back to Hot Springs to play golf. In his first public statement after arriving there, he announced, "I really did some great work at sleeping last night." Meanwhile, Roosevelt was composing an early valedictory for himself, addressed to George Otto Trevelyan. "Of course, if I had conscientiously felt at liberty to run again and try once more to hold this great office, I should greatly have liked to do so and to keep my hands on the levers of this mighty machine. I do not believe that any president has ever had as thoroughly good a time as I have had, or has ever enjoyed himself as much. Moreover, I have achieved a greater proportion than I had dared to think possible of the things I most desired to achieve. Whatever comes hereafter, I have had far more than the normal share of human happiness. But I am bound to say, in addition, that I cannot help looking forward to much enjoyment in the future. In fact, I am almost ashamed to say that while I would have been glad to remain as president, I am wholly unable to feel the slightest regret, the slightest sorrow, at leaving the office. I love the White House, I greatly enjoy the exercise of power, but I shall leave the White House without a pang, and, indeed, on the contrary, I am looking forward eagerly and keenly to being a private citizen again, without anybody being able to make a fuss over me or hamper my movements. I am as interested as I can be at the thought of getting back in my own house at Sagamore Hill, in the thought of the African trip, and of the various things I intend to do when that is over." He was not short of job opportunities. A large corporation offered him its presidency, at a salary of $100,000. The newspaper man, Carr V. Van Anda, offered him the editorship of a new metropolitan daily, to be formed out of a merger of the New York Sun and New York Press. The New York World suggested that he run for the Senate. Henry Adams thought he should emulate John Quincy Adams and become a congressman. Philander Knox suggested he be made a bishop to gratify his need to preach. A New York publisher made a dazzling offer for an exclusive on his post-presidential writings. G.P. Putnam's tried to persuade him to complete his historical saga, The Winning of the West. Scribner's offered him $25,000 for the story of his African adventure, McClure's $72,000, and Collier's $100,000. Lecture invitations came in sackfuls. As before with the Nobel Prize, Roosevelt let his conscience, rather than greed, guide him. He had long ago been approached by the father and son team of Lyman and Lawrence Abbott to join their magazine Outlook as a contributing editor writing on current affairs. Lyman, an ordained clergyman with a strong social conscience, had been particularly persuasive. Although Outlook was not a wealthy periodical, its middle-class, mildly progressive profile appealed to Roosevelt. He gratefully remembered its support during the crises and controversies of his presidency, support that, by such a definition, had been continuous for 7 years. Many magazines less loyal to him now wished to be generous in exchange for what he could do for their circulation figures. For that reason, if for no other, Roosevelt decided to accept Outlook's offer, and in another gesture of loyalty, he signed a first serial and book rights deal with Charles P. Scribner's Sons for $50,000 plus 20% royalties. In both cases, he could easily have doubled or tripled the money elsewhere, but, as he said to his editor at Scribner's, Robert Bridges, "You have got the same standards of propriety that I have." The Abbots proudly announced on 7 November that, on or after the 5th of March, 1909, Theodore Roosevelt will be associated with the Outlook's editorial staff as a special contributing editor. Only 4 days after the election, the president was having to get used to the nude look of his name, shorn of any honorific. Far from being disconcerted, he told Edith that that was how he wanted it styled on his new business cards. She thought Mr. would be more dignified. He thought not, and Archie Butt agreed with him. "I might have known the true Georgians would stand together," she said, laughing. "Why should he not have Mr. Theodore Roosevelt, as any other gentleman would have on his card?" "Because he is not like any other gentleman," Butt said. Mid-November brought the first snow of the season. It fell, melted a little, then froze slick enough to prevent rides in Rock Creek Park. Roosevelt continued to play singles and doubles with members of the tennis cabinet, or, when they were not available, with the ever-willing Archie Butt. He enjoyed the velocity of the ball off the glassy lawn, the sharp air in his lungs, and the exchange of French revolutionary shouts with his favorite partner, Jules Jusserand. "Honneur au courage malheureux, à la lanterne." But as the month progressed, he became oddly silent on court and played with less verve. Butt surmised that he was bracing himself for the return to town of the 60th Congress and its almost certain hostility to any further attempts at reform. If so, his pessimism was justified. His last annual message, issued on 8 December, was so imperious a call for enhanced executive authority that it amounted to a condemnation of the doctrine of checks and balances. "Concentrated power is palpable, visible, responsible, easily reached, quickly held to account. Power scattered through many administrators, many legislators, many men who work behind and through legislators and administrators, is impalpable, is unseen, is irresponsible, cannot be reached, cannot be held to account." His legislative requests were, for the most part, those of previous years, either strengthened or doggedly renewed. For control, complete now, of railroad operations, extended employers' liability and workmen's compensation laws, an 8-hour day in all government departments, forest protection, and inland waterway improvements. The only really new note in Roosevelt's eighth message sounded so extreme, not to say eccentric, that it was criticized more as an attack on the courts than as what it really was, a deep and brilliant perception that justice is not a matter of eternal verities, but of constant case-by-case adaptation to the human prejudices of judges. Every time they interpret contract, property, vested rights, due process of law, liberty, they necessarily enact into law parts of a system of social philosophy, and as such interpretation is fundamental, they give direction to all lawmaking. This suggestion that the judicial branch of government was actually a branchlet of the legislative was almost as revolutionary as Roosevelt's claim that concentration of power was democratic. Although he wrote in language considerably more thoughtful than that of his special message of the previous January, the mere implications of his words were enough to convince conservatives like Joseph Cannon that the best way to treat the president, as his legislative time ran out, was to ignore him. Unless, of course, he was being deliberately and flagrantly provocative, as when he suggested, in another paragraph, that congressmen who had voted to limit the activities of the Secret Service did not themselves wish to be investigated. President-elect Taft arrived in town just in time to coincide with the release of the message, and thus present an alternative image, tranquil and uncomplicated, to Roosevelt's perpetual Sturm und Drang. He was in reality depressed, and wishing that he was headed for the Supreme Court rather than the White House, but reporters were so beguiled by his winks and chuckles that they saw nothing strange in his unwillingness even to consider cabinet appointments until February. "I suppose I must do it then." Roosevelt, beguiled too, told Archie Butt, "He is going to be greatly beloved as president. I almost envy a man who has a personality like Taft's." Then, with a self-mocking leer, "No one could accuse me of having a charming personality." Butt certainly could, after 7 months of almost daily exposure to evidence in proof. Pondering the president's remark, he decided that the difference between Taft and Roosevelt was that of the inanimate versus the animate. Taft's personality was soothing, like a huge pan of sweet milk, whereas Roosevelt's was galvanic. When he comes into a room and stands, as he always does, for 1 second before doing something characteristic, he electrifies the company and gives one just that sensation which a pointer does when he first quivers and takes a stand on quail. About the only trait the two men had in common was their shared love of laughter. In company or alone, they were continually roaring with mirth, Taft quaking from head to foot, Roosevelt so convulsed that he had to hang on to a window frame for support. Members of the Gridiron Club had an opportunity to see them in action on 12 December, as they sat through a skit that satirized Roosevelt's forthcoming role as a paid-by-the-word foreign journalist. The lights were doused, and a voice announced, "We are now in darkest Africa." After a medley of wild animal noises, the lights came on again, revealing a tent in a tropical jungle. From inside came the rattle of a typewriter, punctuated regularly by the sound of a bell that registered not carriage returns, but pecuniary ones. A pair of offstage narrators kept tab as author and auditor. Author, typing furiously, "The lion is a wild and ferocious animal." Auditor, $8. Author, "It has a soft body and a hard face." Auditor, $17. Author, "It is the king of beasts, and its daughter is a princess." Auditor, $29. Author, "The lion roars like distant thunder." Auditor, $35. Author, "But it is nobody's business what its religion is." Auditor, $44. Roosevelt and Taft guffawed throughout, even when the typed article was followed by another, more serious one, explaining that author had gone to Africa to avoid any appearance of interfering with the Taft administration. The Gridiron's exclusively masculine, joke-heavy atmosphere was not conducive to observation of any change in the relationship of president and president-elect. As so often in situations involving transfer of power, it was women who registered the first signals of strain. Edith Roosevelt was upset to hear that Helen Taft intended to replace the White House's frock-coated ushers with liveried black footmen. Mrs. Taft let it be known that she, as a frugal housewife, did not intend to continue the Roosevelt tradition of elaborate entertainments catered from outside. Her guests would be fed out of the White House kitchen, and like it. She also felt that her husband was altogether too much seen as Roosevelt's creature, and urged him to demonstrate his independence. Alice Longworth, who was a gifted, if cruel, mimic, mounted her own propaganda by driving out in the Roosevelt Surrey and rearranging her face into a terrifying caricature of the toothy Mrs. Taft. In mid-December, Washington's social season began with almost nightly receptions, dinners, and balls in and around the White House. The Roosevelts participated graciously, showing no signs of ennui on their eighth procession through the ritual calendar. Yet small signs of impending change darkened each event like speckles on tired transparencies. Elihu Root announced that he was stepping down as Secretary of State, handing 2 months of token power over to Robert Bacon. The president's annual cabinet dinner on 17 December was attended, as usual, by Vice President and Mrs. Fairbanks, but Sonny Jim Sherman showed up too, and so did Philander Knox, no longer as a stalwart of the old Roosevelt cabinet, but as Taft's rumored replacement for Bacon. To the president, at least, this rumor did not suggest any abandonment of what he took to be a pledge by Taft to retain as many existing cabinet officers as possible. He loved Bob Bacon, but the latter's appointment was strictly stopgap. And Root, having been offered a seat in the United States Senate by Republican leaders in New York, would never have stayed on at State. Afterward, talking to Archie Butt, Roosevelt gave his first hint of accepting Taft's right to proceed independently. "I don't feel any resentment at all," he said, "only I hope that he will take care of the men who served me here." All the Roosevelts gathered in the White House for a midday Christmas dinner, along with about 50 relatives and close friends. Bammy came with her drowsy husband, now Admiral Coles, and their son Sheffield, whose fondness for scrapple had made him an early beneficiary of the Pure Food Law. Alice brought Nick, a rather conflicted congressman these days, being the son-in-law of the president and a protege of the president-elect. The Lodges were accompanied by their poetic son, George Cabot, Bay, and his wife and family. The Roots were there, and various Myers and Gardners, and McElhennies and Lowndeses and Eustaces with their children. A few unattributable urchins, possibly gatecrashers from the White House gang, seemed perfectly at home. And the indispensable Archie Butt, who had already been informed that the Tafts wished to keep him on, went about his business of observing and recording. The executive dining room moose looked down impassively on tables decorated with red leaves and ferns and Christmas crackers. Quentin wore a paper crown. Platters of roast turkey went round and round. Brandy-soaked plum puddings were carried in, flickering with blue flame. Little ice cream Santas followed, each holding a tiny burning taper. Afterward, gentlemen smoked in the red room, while the women and children went down into the basement. There, in a specially darkened room, the White House Christmas tree stood out in colored radiance. The Jusserands and Bryces and cabinet officers and their families came from other parties to give and exchange gifts, a volume of G.K. Chesterton's Heretics for Captain Butt. And the president talked politics and kissed whichever child came within reach of his bear hug. No sooner had the debris of this party been swept up the following morning than preparations began for a much more formal event on the 28th, the debut ball of Miss Ethel Roosevelt, age 17. The East Room's floor was polished until it seemed to hold its own inverted chandeliers. 444 places were laid at tables extending right down the length of the upper apartments. The glassed-in eastern colonnade, never used before, was turned into a luminous, flower-hung gallery. Clusters of roses perfumed the blue room, where expressionless Ethel would stand in her white satin gown. A few hours before the party began, Captain Butt escorted Alice Longworth through the mansion. It looked more beautiful than either of them could remember. Time was when Alice, almost 25 now, filling out sexily, more poised and contemplative than in her wild teens, had made a rebellious point of staying away from the White House, but since marrying, she had developed a passionate attachment to it, coming in daily for tea and gossip. Today, she had little to say, but her demeanor struck Archie as unutterably sad. Mr. Speaker, a message from the President of the United States. The traditional call echoed through the House of Representatives on 4 January 1909, in the midst of a furor prompted by Roosevelt's insinuation 1 month before that congressmen did not wish to be investigated by the Secret Service. That remark, coming soon after a sly reference to the criminal classes, had been too much for Senator Aldrich, who had demanded an inquiry into whether the President should be condemned for discourtesy toward Congress. The House had simultaneously challenged Roosevelt to substantiate his words. So far, the second session of the 60th Congress had been, in Alice's words, one long, lovely, crackling row between the White House and Capitol Hill. Her father's 8th annual message had been, for Joseph Cannon, the last of a haystack of straws heaped on the camelback of the Constitution. The Conservation Conference and the Commission on Country Life had been bad enough, he felt, but if any of the significant centralizations of power Roosevelt called for, over the railroads, over telecommunications, over the environment, were made law, states could say goodbye to their individual rights. Progressivism would have finally replaced conservatism with outright socialism, sure to follow. Cannon sat now, gavel in hand, as yet another special message was announced. It elicited such a bedlam of mocking laughter that the speaker had to pound for order for several minutes. The message, when read, amounted to a semi-apologetic withdrawal of Roosevelt's perceived insult to Congress, but he persisted in objecting to a House move to confine the Secret Service's activities strictly to presidential protection and the investigation of counterfeiting. Again, he said, such limitation would benefit the criminal class. He might also have added, but wisely did not, that the House's sudden prejudice against a venerable federal agency was due to rumors that he had been using the Secret Service for his own purposes over the years, harassing Senators Foraker and Tillman and other political opponents, gathering espionage for political campaigns, even getting his bodyguards to fetch and carry for him. There was some substance to these rumors, although evidence of abuse of power was lacking. As the Atlanta Constitution pointed out, the Secret Service had been involved in most of Roosevelt's major initiatives, from antitrust probes and peonage prosecutions to pure food sleuthing and the grilling of Brownsville discharges. Its chief, John E. Wilkie, was a known favorite of the president. The force was tiny, only 10 full-time agents, but Wilkie had funds to hire an unlimited number of private detectives for whatever purposes he deemed fit. It was these funds and these purposes that anti-Rooseveltians in Congress sought to restrict, conveniently focusing years of resentment against the president for his steady transfer of power away from Capitol Hill. The Secret Service's necessarily covert nature only fueled the suspicions of conspiracists in politics and the press, seeking, as conspiracists always do, a central intelligence behind diverse activities. These rumor mongers ignored the fact that many other government departments used confidential agents, not under Wilkie's or Roosevelt's direct control. The irony was that the president himself wanted to concentrate all such activities in one federal bureau of investigation, answerable to the attorney general, if not to the general public. So conspiracism clashed with coordination, and 7 years of cumulative frustration exploded in jeers and catcalls. The chorus unhappily coincided with a debate on the very subjects Roosevelt had raised. After 7 hours of mounting rancor, the House handed him a rebuke unprecedented since the days of Andrew Jackson, voting to table his new message as so much white paper. Thus, little more than 8 weeks before the end of his presidency, Roosevelt reached the nadir of his relations with Congress. But, to his great personal glee, the House's very action made it seem as if it was indeed afraid of an empowered Secret Service, because certain representatives might have things to hide. Effectively, if not legislatively, he came out looking like a political winner. "Nobody likes him now but the people," Ambassador Bryce remarked. Archie Butt was amazed at the president's good-humored calm after his rejection by the House. While Mrs. Roosevelt chafed, her husband chuckled at Congressman Longworth's discomfiture. "Poor Nick, what he is not suffering for love's sake these days." He was heard laughing heartily over a newspaper transcript of Benjamin Tillman's latest anti-Roosevelt tirade in the Senate, and that night waltzed at a White House ball, happy and flushed as a boy. Butt wrote home, "I think he sees more clearly than the rest of us do, or else he has no nerves at all." One legislative request that Congress was powerless to deny him because of its guarantee of last April was an appropriation for two more all-big-gun battleships. It came through on 22 January, adding an extra glow of celebration to the White House Army and Navy reception. Roosevelt could, and did, congratulate himself on having built up a Navy second only now to that of Great Britain in first-class capital ships, with vastly improved design and marksmanship standards. All that remained to complete his sense of satisfaction was the return of the Great White Fleet, scheduled for exactly 1 month's time. February, the month in which Taft had set himself a languid deadline for the appointment of his cabinet, found Roosevelt showing, for the first time, occasional hints of melancholy. He was saddened to hear that the Ohio Society of New York had declined to drink to his health at its recent annual banquet, presumably because the president-elect's brother was present. "I do not believe that it was done with a view to aid in the divorcement of Taft and myself, as some friends seem to think," he said to Archie Butt. The captain thought otherwise, but kept silent. Nothing but disillusioning news had come from the Taft camp for the past several weeks. Of all the current cabinet, only George Von L. Meyer, at latest report, stood a chance of being reappointed. So much for Taft's promise of continuity. Roosevelt, still refusing to believe the worst of his erstwhile laughing companion, went on as if trying to convince himself. "They little realize that Taft is big enough to carve out his own administration on individual lines. I felt he was the one man for the presidency, and any failure in it would be as keenly felt by me as by himself or his family." Then, in a revealing free association, he went on, "You have heard some things said against my administration, Archie, but they are nothing to what you will hear when I am completely robbed of power and in Africa. But when the history of this period is written down, I believe my administration will be known as an administration of ideals." He cheered up in the days that followed as carpenters invaded the upper floor of the White House and began to box up books and other Washington acquisitions for transfer to Sagamore Hill. Roosevelt went into a distributive frenzy as memento seekers, hearing that he could not resist a sad face, kept making meaningful visits. "Why, Mother," Ethel complained, "he has given away nearly everything in the study, and Auntie Corinne and every other guest in the White House have their arms full of pictures, books, and souvenirs." Only when carpenters transferred their hammering and sawing to Lafayette Square, and a review stand for the coming inaugural parade rose outside the North Gate, did the realization sink in that he was about to give away the largest memento of all, a presidency immeasurably enhanced in force, glamour, and power. At Hampton Roads, on 22 February, Roosevelt stood for the last time as Commander-in-Chief on the bridge of the Mayflower. He strained his one good eye through a pair of naval binoculars, trying to glimpse what everyone around him saw clearly, distant white superstructures looming through gray rain and fog. "Here they are," he eventually shouted, feeling rather than seeing, as the sound of 28 ships' bands playing the Star-Spangled Banner grew in volume to the rhythmic crash of cannon. The music, the gunpowder, the echelons of saluting blue jackets, all were for him and for history. "That is the answer to my critics," he said, his top hat glistening in the wet air. "Another chapter is complete, and I could not ask a finer concluding scene for my administrations." Epilogue, 4 March 1909. At a time when he was still able to joke about his future, William Howard Taft used to say, "It will be a cold day when I go into the White House." He was right, although he could not have imagined how cold. His inauguration was the most Arctic any Washingtonian could remember. For many of the visitors whose trains managed to scrabble into town, along rails carbuncled with rock-hard ice, it was the worst weather they had known in their lives. A brutal west wind drove in billows of snow. Branch loads of ice crashed from trees, some bringing down tangled decorations. Ice sheaths snapped telephone and telegraph wires, cutting off communications with the rest of the country. Freezing rain sent automobiles careening, carriage horses sliding, and streetcars to unscheduled terminals. And the sullen sky discharged such further quantities of snow that groundsmen gave up any attempt to keep the eastern Capitol Plaza clear. At 11 o'clock, spectators were told that the swearing-in ceremony was being transferred indoors. Arriving guests had to find their own way to the Senate chamber and their own seats when they got there. The rough pine platform built for the swearing-in whitened slowly as it stood abandoned, bare of all bunting. "I knew there would be a blizzard when I went out," said Roosevelt with grim satisfaction. He left the White House with Taft at 10 o'clock, and they were driven to the Capitol in a 12-team equipage, whipped by flying snow. Pennsylvania Avenue was lined with empty bleachers. A few hundred well-wishers straggled along the sidewalks, walking to keep warm, easily keeping up with the presidential carriage. They cheered occasionally, "Oh, you Teddy!" But their mood seemed more sad than celebratory. Roosevelt kept dropping his window and waving at them until the snow clouds forced him to raise it again. Progress was so slow that the procession did not crest Capitol Hill until shortly before 11. A small, familiar figure awaited Roosevelt and Taft at the foot of the Senate steps, that of Philander Knox, exuding triple dignity as Senator, Secretary of State Designate, and Chairman of the Congressional Welcoming Committee. He led the way to the President's room, where a final bureaucratic duty awaited Roosevelt, the signing of a pile of bills that had been passed overnight. The 60th Congress and he were going out together. There had been precious little else they had done in tandem over the last couple years. Roosevelt's entire cabinet was on hand to witness this ritual. Scrupulous to the last, he handed each bill out to the appropriate officer for approval before taking it back and writing his name. Taft, meanwhile, played host to politicians, drifting in to pay their respects. Toward noon, the flow of visitors slowed. Roosevelt finished his work and went to join Taft. They chatted and laughed with much of their old warmth, but a sense of strain was apparent between them. They soon ran out of conversation and sat side by side in silence until the President got up to bid farewell to a few departing guests. One of them was Captain Butt, already transferred to Taft's service, and not entirely happy about it. He choked as he tried to say goodbye. "It isn't goodbye," Roosevelt said to soothe him. "We will meet again, and possibly you will serve me in a more important capacity than the one you have now." Butt had little time to ponder this strange remark, for Vice President Fairbanks had come through the door with Sherman and announced that the march would begin at once. The hands of the grandfather clock stood at 12:12. As Taft and Roosevelt followed their assigns down the corridor and into the Senate chamber, where a sudden roar greeted them. Observers were struck by Roosevelt's immobile concentration as his successor was sworn in. Those who did not know him thought that the stony expression and balled-up fists signaled trouble ahead for Taft. His sister, Bammy, describing the scene to Corinne Roosevelt Robinson afterward, got only "the most wonderful feeling of dignity and strength, and people who had really not cared for him suddenly realized what a great man he was." In fact, he was making a special effort not to distract attention from the new President of the United States. An occasional curt nod indicated his approval of points made in Taft's subsequent speech. Roosevelt's fabled vigor was apparent only at the end, when he bounded out of his seat and ran up the steps of the rostrum to shake Taft by the hand. The two men embraced briefly, then stood talking, their hands on each other's shoulders. "There was not a dry eye in the place," Bammy wrote, "and everyone's throat contracted. As he said goodbye, before anyone realized what was happening, he went down the steps from the speaker's desk and bowing and smiling, went out of the little side door. It was the simplest, most dramatic exit imaginable, and left the whole packed Senate with a tremor going through it. The snow had stopped falling during the ceremony, and Roosevelt found a large, boisterous crowd of well-wishers waiting for him when he emerged onto the plaza outside. Mounted police tried to hold them back as they surged and roared, "Goodbye, Mr. President." It was no longer his title, but they were clearly unwilling to give it to another. William Loeb, Jr. was on hand, as so often before, starting at North Creek in the Adirondacks, to escort Roosevelt to his train. A drab honor guard of about 1,000 New York County Republicans formed a rectangle about the carriage and led the way toward Union Station to thumping band music while the crowd followed. The general mood was festive, but when the band segued into Auld Lang Syne, a sudden valedictory pall descended. Thousands of voices swelled the chorus, and the mass of marchers began to sway to the tune's slow rhythm. "For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne." Roosevelt, who had been laughing and brandishing his silk hat, lapsed into quietness. Loeb furtively watched him, afraid he might break down. But by the time they arrived at the station, the band had switched to "There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight," and Roosevelt was as jovial as ever. "Goodbye to you all," he shouted in his high, cracking voice, and leaped out of the carriage the moment it rolled to a halt. Before the crowd could close around him, he had disappeared. Edith Roosevelt received him in the new terminal's magnificent President's Room, as yet, and still, unused by any chief executive of the United States. Quentin was with her, looking triumphant, because he had managed to sneak into the Capitol without a pass. He and Taffy had watched the inauguration together, squeezed into one seat in the Taft family row. A special train was waiting, but ice delayed its departure for 2 wearying hours. Roosevelt was forced to hold an impromptu reception, as hundreds of Washington friends and diplomats, including a tearful Jules Jusserand, came to wish him well, and over again, good hunting. Just as frequently, he assured everyone who would listen that he had had a bully time as president, but was happy to lay down the burden of office. Shortly after 3 o'clock, the railway north was cleared, and Roosevelt passed with his wife and son through a crowd that had swelled to several thousand. The vast station hall reverberated with roars as he waved, flashed his teeth and pince-nez, and disappeared down the platform. At 3:26 on the station register, Theodore Roosevelt officially departed Washington, D.C. The storm had abated, but with wires down and only hand signals operating for the next 30 miles, the train took more than 2 hours to get to Baltimore. By then, darkness had fallen, and Roosevelt did not show himself, as if to emphasize to a small, wistful crowd that he was no longer public property. 7 years and 169 days before, on another lowering evening, he had come south along this same track, eager to begin work as President of the United States. For all his show of grief for McKinley and natural nervous tension, he had been happy then, as he was happy now, happy at the large things he had managed to achieve, a canal, a coal strike settlement, a peace treaty, a national conservation conference. Contented with myriad smaller triumphs, proud of his appointees, passionate about his country, in love with his wife and children. Many friended, much honored, lusty in his physical and intellectual appetites, constantly bubbling with mirth. Happy above all at having kept his promise not to hold on too long to power. Brownsville had been proof to many, and perhaps even a warning to himself, of the truth of Lord Acton's famous dictum. Already in his 51st year, epitaphs of him were beginning to appear, distressingly written in the past historic, from H.G. Wells's claim that he seemed a very symbol of the creative will in man, to Henry Adams's, "Roosevelt, more than any other living man within the range of notoriety, showed the singular primitive quality that belongs to ultimate matter, the quality that medieval theology assigned to God. He was pure act." In time, no doubt, the inevitable memorial committee would form, and solemn scholars would comb his works for quotations suitable to chisel in stone. Statute books and official histories would celebrate his administrative achievements. The Monroe Doctrine reaffirmed, the old world banished from the new world, the great canal being cut, peace established in the Far East, the open door swinging freely in Manchuria and Morocco, Cuba liberated and returned to self-government just in time for his departure, the Philippines pacified, the navy hugely strengthened, known literally around the world, the army, shorn of its old deadwood generals, feeling the green sap of younger replacements, capital and labor balanced off, the lynch rate declining, the gospel of cleaner politics, now actually gospel, and enough progressive principles established, or made part of the national debate, to keep legislative reformers busy for at least 10 years. But for millions of contemporary Americans, he was already memorialized in the 18 national monuments and 5 national parks he had created by executive order or cajoled out of Congress. The inventory, as Gifford Pinchot would say, included protected pinnacles, a crater lake, a rainforest and a petrified forest, a wind cave and a jewel cave, cliff dwellings, a cinder cone and skyscraper of hardened magma, sequoia stands, glacier meadows, and the grandest of all canyons. Less solidly, but equally enduringly, he left behind a folk consensus that he had been the most powerfully positive American leader since Abraham Lincoln. He had spent much of his 2 terms crossing and recrossing the country, east and west, south and north, reminding anyone who would listen to him that he embodied all America's variety and the whole of its unity, that what he had made of his own life was possible to all, even to boys born as sickly as himself. Uncounted men, women, and children who had crowded around the presidential caboose to stare and listen to him now carried, forever etched in memory, the image of his receding grin and wave. This concludes the reading of Theodore Rex by Edmund Morris. This book was read by Jonathan Mayrose.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.